You know, the work that you're doing in the crypto AI space, it's like so much is happening every day. It's having all kind of repercussions. What does responsibility as a word mean to you in your everyday work as a founder in this space?
Well, it's a great question. You know, we started the Auric 3 years ago, and at the time, crypto and AI was not a popular topic. A lot of people were skeptical, but we believed, having worked in the AI space a long time, that it was going to be utterly transformative technology, change our lives, and doing it in a way where the community could govern and set a direction so it lands in a positive way was incredibly important to us. You know, I had been at places like Google and seen how big monopolists behave, even with good intended people. And so, you know, responsibility is like, how do we steer this technology to benefit all of humanity in a serious way? And of course, you see that even companies that maybe start off with a mission to create AGI safely for the benefit of all humanity, OpenAI, for example, start to pivot and change over time, right? So responsibility means having the right governance in a way that everyone can participate and not rely on the good intentions of a few billionaires.
Definitely get that vision. Yeah, and so good to see you, Ron. So maybe let's expand a little bit on that. How did your experience at Google shape your vision for the Auric?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the reasons I had joined Google, joined the CTO office in Google Cloud, you know, it was back in 2017. I believed AI was going to be transformative technology, that Google was clearly the leader at the time. They were clearly the leader in the space, and that there was an opportunity to have a real impact on how AI rolled out in the world. But what I saw was that, you know, efforts around responsible AI, sort of governing AI, you know, when you really dug in, it was very much being treated like a lot of corporate social responsibility, you know, kind of a PR exercise, a check the box, let's make sure we say the right things. But everyone's motivation was, let's go ahead and race ahead and do this in a way that drives commercial impact, right? Seek profit, which is not surprising for a private company. And even though there were a lot of people with good intentions, the end output in the system was not a good one. The other thing I saw already at Google at that time was it was just a big bureaucracy. And so it was very hard for it to really organize and get things done, right? And so it was also not being very effective at leading anything and delivering products, as well as not doing so in a responsible way. And it just didn't align with where I wanted to be and, you know, led me on a journey. I went to be then at Vector Institute, leading nonprofit AI research lab in Toronto with, you know, 500 researchers, built a large engineering team to support them and 100 industry sponsors. But, you know, I concluded that also being in a nonprofit was way less impactful than really starting a company at the intersection of Web3 and AI, and that led to the Auric.
That's incredible. Congrats on the journey so far. So, you know, what was it like at the beginning when you decided to found ChainML and also the Auric? You know, what went through your mind? And also, how did you start, you know, on this Web3 train versus, you know, raising money in the equity side, doing Web2 AI startup? Because I'm sure that at that time, it's also very popular. How did you jump on the crypto wagon?
Yeah, I mean, so it's back to this point that, you know, I've been involved in Web3, you know, had been an advisor to Consensus, sort of key organization developing Ethereum, you know, with Joe Lubin and Jeremy Miller and others in the leadership team advising them when they were a startup based on my experiences as an entrepreneur, and, you know, continued to stay engaged. I advised the founders of Space and Time, Scott and Nate, who were colleagues at Teradata after I sold my startup Think Big Analytics to Teradata, which was enterprise AI built on big data. And, you know, working with them and David Post, who at the time was at Chainlink, you know, really saw that there was a real appetite around infrastructure in Web3 and felt there was a huge opportunity that, you know, it could really be a place where you could build a different kind of AI company, because I felt Web3 was important. Like, building a Web2 startup really is not going to let you address things like governance and, you know, ideals of decentralization. How do you address the power balance in a Web2 startup? You're going to be 100% focused on going and selling to CTOs and CMOs or whatever your segment is, and you're going to build a SaaS business because that's where the incentives all lie, you know. And like that did not at all connect with me for the ideals of how to impact and have a better future for AI. You know, there's of course, you know, at the time there were already hundreds, and now there's tens of thousands of such startups, but I don't think they're going to have any meaningful impact on the trajectory of AI. Whereas I think building in Web3, we have a real chance to change that trajectory in a positive way. And you know, it's also interesting, like if you look at it, people in Web2 are saying things like, you know, when will the first $1 billion agent company be out there? And it's like, you aren't paying attention. There are several multi-billion dollar agent companies in Web3 because we're speed running, and there's lots more multi-hundred million dollar ones, right? So like it's actually racing ahead, like the access to community capital and participation and true open source building in public is outpacing Web2 startups as well.
That's incredible. Yeah, I know you guys are, you know, ahead of curve on the agent side. You know, now AI agents, you know, all over the place, but you guys were, you know, on this trajectory way earlier, and also bringing a ton of experience from, you know, big companies, right? So maybe let's take this chance, because there's a few different entities involved here. And also I think this, you know, you've gone through, you know, some refinement in your vision as well. Maybe you can explain to us on the vision of Theoric, TNML, and also the work you're doing.
Yeah, so TNML is a labs company. It develops Theoric, right? That's the product, and that's the thing it's focusing on. So that's the connection there. So we talk mostly about Theoric because that's the protocol, and that's what's really getting adoption. And yeah, you know, we're always building in the intersection of Web3 and AI, and we very quickly concluded that AI agents building more autonomous systems using the power of LLMs, generative AI models, was going to be incredibly impactful, right? So we've been building, you know, frameworks and technology for things like collaborating agents to do analysis and planning, right? We partnered with Space and Time to build Houston early set of agents to help people interacting with that database. And, you know, we realized that that was the basis of a really powerful protocol. And we spent last year and end of the year before building the Theoric protocol. We launched our testnet last fall, really, to make it easy for multiple agents to communicate in natural language, to have binding contracts, to establish reputation, right? And these are all critical aspects of what you need, right? I mean, we were, as you noted, Kenzie, ahead of the market. I think now the market's starting to wake up and realize, you know, coordinating swarms of agents is a really important problem. You can't have them communicate over Twitter at scale. And how do you have reliability and contracts? It's like, well, this is great. We've built all of that. We have this awesome protocol that's already proven out where, you know, we serve, you know, about 100 million requests in our first test net with 500,000 active users. And, you know, it's battle tested. But, you know, what's exciting now is the market is ready for it and starting to really hunger for things like how to trading agents collaborate. And, you know, so what we've built is very much, you know, it's evolved as we've learned and from customer adoption. And, you know, now we've got this amazing protocol and technology that is just what the market needs.
Yes. Well, maybe tell us more about this agent collab, agent collective concept. You know, is this along the line of Swarm, you know?
Yeah,
let's go a little bit deeper.
We called it collectives because we were ahead of the market, and then OpenAI started talking about the same idea a few months later and called it swarms, and everyone just copied them. So fine, you know, if everyone wants to call it swarms, it's swarms, right? It's multiple agents working together. And I think the really important thing, though, is like we've always designed it from the standpoint of you're not going to have an idea that like one developer is going to build all the agents and build them so they only work together as like this grouping. There's some people doing that. And it's like that kind of multi-agent system just can't scale, right? Because like there's so many interesting projects building agents and contributing new capabilities out there that, you know, you need to be able to have them dynamically discover each other and work together and, you know, constantly have innovation and specialization. So you need to have swarms or collectives that are composed dynamically. But in that world, you also need to have a way of having reputation and knowing what agents are working well. And in fact, a really important part, back to this question of responsibility, is like, how do you create incentives so that you have pro-social agents that actually, you know, agents that follow the rules and, you know, are good actors, interact in a positive way with other agents, are rewarded, and you don't create a race to the bottom where manipulative, toxic, negative agents have all the incentives and win out, right? So there's a lot to get right in setting up the incentive structure and the way to have agents work together. But I think, you know, there's a lot of incentive for people. Like, as you work with agents, you really want to have, you don't want to have the Web 2 model, right? Where like OpenAI is like, well, trust us, we're going to define all the good agents. And if you really must, you know, you could go dredge something out of our marketplace, but, you know, we're going to like be the primary source, right? We don't think people want that, where one monopolist defines everything. But at the same time, you know, having a dark forest of agents where there's lots of fraudsters and hackers, and they're creating agents to drain your wallet and so on, like, that's not a viable option either. You really need strong community governance and incentives in order to make the system work well. So those are key aspects. And, you know, very quickly, what we think is, you know, some of the first uses are around what's called DeFi, right? Decentralized finance with AI, where, you know, people are going to be able to have agents act on their behalf and help them identify opportunities and trade and collaborate. You know, like, that is going to be incredibly important. It's an area that we're putting a lot of focus and emphasis. We've already done meaningful work on that, like, you know, investment planner collective to make it easy to access multiple data sources to analyze investments and track emerging tokens and participate in prediction markets and like Polymarket, right? So we've already done a lot of work of that on that lines, and, you know, lots more coming, right? We have some partners who are very excited about this and excited for the next phase of Theoric to really enable that, right? So collectives or swarms are central there, because, you know, you'll have lots of different ways of detecting what's going on in the market, lots of different ways of analyzing and determining good trading strategies, and lots of ways of executing those trades. And, you know, we don't believe that any one organization is going to build all that tech. And we don't think it's all going to be even developed under one framework, right? We're going to have lots of innovative technology, and they need to dynamically discover. And the beautiful thing is, agents communicate in natural language. So you don't have to have like really hard to develop complex protocol APIs. They can have much simpler, rigorous APIs with meaningful, you know, smart contracts to enforce behavior, but a lot of the details are negotiated in natural language.
That's super cool. I think right now we're really living at this super exciting juncture of crypto and also AI. You know, these agents are evolving super fast, especially, on crypto Twitter, you see a lot of these new, you know, fair launched agents are doing different things. And you're trying to set up a framework and introducing, you know, your agents and also your swarm network into it. So what do you see would be kind of a point that these will become more standardized? Because right now it's like a Wild West. There's no standardization. And I'm not even sure how innovative these, you know, agent frameworks are. You can probably also tell me, you know, your perspective on some of these. Maybe they're not that advanced. They're just like, you know, all talk. But what do you think we go from this Wild West of like, you know, a bunch of, you know, 2-3 weeks iteration type of thing going into like a new paradigm?
I mean, I think there's going to continue to be rapid iteration and evolution, right? That's like definitely the trend. And, you know, if anything, the use of AI-powered coding tools like Cursor and Replit are just enabling builders to build faster, which is great, right? And I think, you know, the history of open source is that you get flourishing frameworks. So it's not surprising you've got lots of exciting frameworks, right? And you've got things like RIG that are really well-engineered agent frameworks for Web3, but, you know, you require Rust, which is not a language that many agent devs want to use. You've got, you know, things like Eliza that put together quickly, but not something that's been very because of that, it's somewhat complicated, and it's got some deployment limitations and so on. But obviously a lot of adoption excitement, so we see it like LangChain and Web2 is sort of like a framework that a lot of people start developing agents, and then they realize that building a more capable agents requires different capabilities. Maybe build more custom. But the point is, like, there's so many different frameworks out there. I think that the frameworks are great for building one agent, and there will be not a thousand flowers bloom. There's going to be many of them, right? I think what's more important is protocols, right? Which is like, what are ways that these agents can discover and communicate? That's what we're building, like a swarm protocol, Theoric. So you could build your agent with any tech, and it's very lightweight and simple to connect it in and to start to communicate and interact with other agents, right? And so, like, if you want a capability, you want to access data, or you want to, execute a trade with a securely managed wallet, you can go integrate that capability with your agent using the protocol and then have access to a whole network of that, right? So we think that's going to be the evolution, is people are going to start saying, hey, there's this great set of capabilities out there that I can leverage using a protocol. And however I've built my agent, it's a real upside for me to have those capabilities. And then conversely, the agent I've built now can get more adoption, more excitement, more leverage, more value by contributing to such a protocol, right? So I think that's how we're going to see more and more of these swarms emerging, is, there's incentive for agent builders to contribute and to leverage them.
Maybe you can tell us a bit about your, going from corporate AI leader to now a crypto startup AI, founder. Must be so much difference, right? Different life in a way. So tell us the challenges that you face now.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some differences. I mean, I would say, though, I've been involved in open source projects a long time, earlier technologies like aspect-oriented programming, where I worked with the open source team at Xerox PARC building AspectJ. I've been involved in enterprise Java, a lot of open source there, prior to focusing on AI and machine learning, and of course in AI and machine learning, lots of open source technologies. So open source is really a powerful way of getting communities to contribute. But the big gap in open source traditionally has been, or isn't, a good business model. Traditional Web2 open source is a rug, because every time a open source project graduates, they stop building open source and they switch to commercial, and like, we've got you locked in, and now we're going to force you to pay to keep using our stuff, right? So like, the cool thing in Web3 is you have this ability to have self-sustaining protocols that have revenue associated. So you keep building and open. So in a way, it's like the Web3 movement lets us fulfill what we always wanted to do, but going around with a tip jar begging people to contribute to open source isn't a viable business model. And, bait and switching people into open core, i.e. pay for the real software, is not a great place to be either, right? So there's that. And I'd also say that, like, Web3 startups are, of course, different in meaningful ways than Web2 startups, mostly just because, what I think is, like, technology just keeps accelerating. And so you end up having more leverage and more speed and faster access to capital. And, Web3 is at the forefront. But, in my career, I've been an entrepreneur since early on. I dropped out of the PhD program at MIT to start a company, it's just been a continued evolution of, like, accelerating. And, the other thing I'd say is, I think, one thing that Web3, for a while was, so narrative driven that people were, getting a lot of success even without shipping products that worked. But I think, like, that's actually starting to correct to faster time to get to product market fit. But, like, if you look at it, we as a leadership team with Theoric are really excited that there's real adoption for AI agents. They're resonating, they're moving fast, right? We've gone from, social agents to agents that are doing analysis, and now very quickly into DFA and trading agents. The point is, you're getting real adoption and usage. And so, you know, how do you build a startup where you focus on product market fit and get real feedback from customers and move quickly? Like, that's a very familiar space, right? The building to narrative without product market fit, which is a bit more of the advice and direction, you know, from a year and a half ago, that was really alien to me. But, you know, I think our instincts and background as experienced builders in Web2 and startups really play well in the current market.
Yeah, in a way, this is actually the way it should be. It's some kind of survival of the fittest, right? Survival of the fittest for the agents and also for the startups that make these agents. So what you're saying is that the success that you define for this, you know, area is consumer product adoption. How many agents are deployed? Is there anything else that you think are kind of quantifiable success metrics for entrepreneurs in the decentralized AI space?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, there's both short term, like, you know, what is the adoption, you know, metrics, like, you know, and anything financial, you look at things like trading volumes those are obvious ways of quantifying, you know, various forms of usage, metrics. Those can be fine, but, you know, it's easy to have usage without it necessarily being high value usage, right? And of course, there's lots of gaming of metrics in Web3, right? Lots of vanity metrics, right? So, you know, so I think when you look at places where there's skin in the game and people are really, you know, doing financial activity, like, that's not gameable in the same way, right? It's a real strong voting, you know, with skin in the game to say this is a high quality product that I love. I think, though, over the longer term, it's also about the success of the ecosystem. And, you know, there's other metrics that matter, like swarming and scale of swarms. And, you know, that's just emerging. Like, the narrative's there and we clearly see early use cases, but we'll build out. And of course, it will broaden, right? There'll be other use cases where there's financial value beyond trading. It's just the obvious initial use case for agents in Web3 is trading crypto, right? So DeFi is emerging. And, you know, I think it's going to be way higher impact and, you know, various personality agents that are interacting on social, but don't have as much of a purpose.
So Theryx testnet achieved decent adoption with hundreds of thousands of users. Like, what strategies or initiatives led to this success?
You know, I think it was, a lot of it was organic interest that, like, you know, we went out, we spoke at a lot of events, you know, we partnered with you folks at Sentient and other great partners to get out there and talk about it. You know, we'd been in the space a long time and writing, and, you know, people got excited by that. People got excited that, you know, we had some really innovative agents. You know, like, when I was at DevCon back in November, met a lot of other founders who were like, we tried a lot of the, you know, AI projects in Web3, and the quality of what's available in the Theryx testnet is a cut above, and it's a lot more useful when I'm doing things like analyzing tokens and looking at prediction markets. So I think those were also factors that led to the excitement and the success of the testnet. At the same time, you know, one of the things that we did at our testnet was much more of a one-to-one, you know, you interact with a single agent, and that's an important mode, but, you know, the one-to-many agents interacting on Twitter, X, and Telegram took off as the first medium for, you know, more widespread use of agents. So, you know, we're adding that in as the next stage of the protocol. But one to many, we think at scale, we'll need, you know, strong messaging backbone, right? That as agents are able to do billions of transactions a day and more, you know, that, like, that's not going to go through Twitter or Telegram. There's going to need to be different messaging infrastructure. But we think they're both important. So I think those were some of the reasons. It's just a great community, and word of mouth obviously played a big factor as well.
How does Theryx build on your earlier work at ChainML to push decentralized AI innovation forward?
Yeah, I mean, so the ChainML's continued to build all the technology, right? So it's like, we built, how do you make agents collaborate together? How do you have them do things like planning to break down a problem into steps, and how do you orchestrate among multiple agents to work together, right? So there's a lot of that. And, you know, the ChainML continues to develop the technology, you know, both, you know, strong AI research team that are very innovative around how do you really get agents to do effective things, to interact with users and help clarify and deliver what they want. How do you make them work together? How do you assess and dynamically select agents and swarms? Those are some of the kinds of innovations. And then on the engineering side, you know, just robust, scalable infrastructure, right? Like, we had no problems technically as we scaled to, like, I think it peaked 2 million requests a day in our first testnet, right? So, you know, I think those things that we bring as a very strong, experienced team building in AI, the AI space for a long time, really shone through in our experience and what we built in the protocol.
What role do AI agent swarms play in transforming industries like finance or like data science?
Yeah, I mean, I think finance is sort of the first place. And, you know, this is because crypto is speed running and ahead of adoption of agents elsewhere. What we see happening is it's starting with enabling people to access the financial system, to have better strategies in trading crypto. But, you know, we think the next stage of that will be with real world assets. Now you start to have more meaningful reason for people to adopt tokenization and interaction with, you know, any number of assets like, you know, stocks and bonds and ETFs and so on, using the same agent technology. And then we think it's going to continue to percolate out into the broader workforce, that basically we think AI adoption with agents is being driven much more bottoms up by professionals doing it for themselves. Even in Web 2, what we're seeing is that a majority of knowledge workers and large companies are now actually using generative AI, but a majority of them are not telling their boss, right? So like the tools that are available as an individual are way more powerful and helpful than corporate policies are keeping up. And so this is where we think Web3 is going to race ahead and keep building more and more AI capabilities, and that they're going to be adoption of that will be much more bottoms up. Just like, you know, companies didn't study smartphones and decide that iPhones are a good tool. It's like everyone's adopted them bottoms up, prosumer, and then eventually companies like, this is really valuable, we need to do something, right? And I think in the same way, the Web3 community is going to create so much incentive and innovation that swarms of agents will solve problems better than, you know, corporate teams trying to do POCs with, you know, Y Combinator startups building a SaaS product for something, right? Because the inherent nature of AI agents is it's just going to be easier and easier to solve better and better problems. And like all the overhead of like a specialized startup doesn't make a lot of sense, right? So you hear people say these weird things like, you're going to have one person startups. And it's like, at that point, why do you need the startup? Like, just let the user say what they want and the agent will do it for them. Or maybe, you know, with collectives, with swarms, you can go tap a little bit of expertise here and there that has some special secret sauce, right? So we think it's going there, and that's going to be utterly transformative in the economy, right? And I think we're in the lead in Web3, like what we're building in swarm technology, like that could be utterly transformative for the economy. But I mean, even just starting in the finance sector, just a massive, massive opportunity and could really be transformative.
So what's your vision for is it DeFi? DeFi, DeFi AI, and how does it fit into the broader AI ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really DeFi or DeFi, I don't know how you pronounce it, but it's like decentralized finance by AI, right? It's like, now, yeah, I defy you to say it. You know, you've got this idea that like you can have AI agents that manage decentralized finance for you. So it simplifies usability. It gives you the ability to get alpha by trading quickly. It lets you have, you know, more coherent discussions. You don't need to be, you know, have a whole hedge fund in order to have like smart money management that follows your strategy and gives you feedback and empowers you to act, right? So all kinds of people who are excited by crypto and excited to participate in the space, investing, you know, can now be empowered, right? And you really level the playing field with the hedge funds, the sort of the large pools of capital that are out there trading, right? So so we think it's a very, it's a big opportunity. We think it's sort of the next phase of evolution of finance. You know, we think it's starting with, you know, tokens and trading and, you know, whether it be like agent tokens seem to be ground zero for it, you know, where people are realizing like having a token associated with any given product makes a lot of sense, but it'll expand out to a larger universe of tokens. And then, as I say, I think over time, real world assets are also going to get tokenized and become much more popular because of DeFi capabilities.
Could you explain how Theorex proof of contribution and proof of collaboration mechanisms enable trust and performance?
Absolutely. Right. So the idea is proof of collaboration is about looking at a swarm altogether and sort of assessing how well it worked and then with evidence on chain. And then proof of contribution is how an individual agent in that swarm performed, right? So by allowing recording durable audit trails that are anchored on chain, right? You have non-repudiation, so you could know and go back. And then have the protocol has this concept of evaluators that can go and apply whatever rule to assess like what is the quality of contribution based on that historical evidence, right? So it's open, right? So the protocol allows a variety of such specialized agents to be written. So, you know, you can have one that sort of goes back and an obvious thing in DeFi is to evaluate the portfolio performance of a given agent, right? In similar way, like you can have one that sort of does an attribution to say among this collective, like how much did this one contribute to this trading decision, right? And assign credit or blame, depending if it ended up being a good trade, right? So that's the core concept of proof of collaboration to assess the swarm as a whole and see how well they work together and then contribution individual agents in the swarm doing their own part.
So the Theorex light paper outlines the pillars of the protocol, interoperability, composability, and decentralized innovation. How did you prioritize these pillars and how do you think they're crucial for the future of AI and Web3?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're all sort of essential in the sense that if you can't interoperate, you know, it really is a blocker, right? So the very concept of the swarm is interoperating agents, and you know, the key insight is that agents speak natural language and can communicate a natural language, so it's much easier to get them to interoperate, and you have much richer semantics. You know, composability. This is one of the beautiful things about smart contracts is, you know, it's really easy to call one smart contract from another. You need to extend it into the realm of AI agents working together. So you can make it easy for an agent to discover new capabilities, to include it, to leverage it, right? And similarly, decentralization of innovation. Again, it's like there's just so many brilliant people out there. And, you know, I think that's one of the powerful things of Web3. So again, extending that concept of many people can build, it comes together, that open source, open contributions, now just brings it into the AI arena and brings those AI capabilities into the Web3 arena. So that's also essential. So I don't know how you prioritize among them. I think they're all sort of essential and core, right?
And with the Theorex token playing a central role in the protocol, like what challenges did you face with designing its economic and governance model?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is the role of AI protocols and the role of tokens in those protocols is evolving so quickly. The market's learning; it's moving, you know, at a lightning speed, right? So, you know, I think there's there's some clear principles around, you know, making sure that the Theorex token will be important for governance and will play a role in utility and sort of create a way to secure the overall protocol and ensure, you know, alignment of interests. So, you know, I'd say that there's still a little bit, you know, the market's moving so fast, we haven't yet updated to share more details, but, you know, that will be coming soon.
How did you assemble your team? Like what qualities did you prioritize when you were hiring at Theorex, or like what kind of challenges did you face while hiring?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is that you know, the leadership team of the organization are all people I've worked with before and know and trust, and I think like there's just no replacement for that, right? It's like you might hire somebody and they seem good on paper. They might even appear to be a good actor for a few months, and then they suddenly, you know, if you don't have that long history, you know, it can turn out the other way, right? So especially for starting a company and, you know, having that level of trust and shared experience is a huge leg up versus like trying to go out and you know, and meet new founders for the first time. So hiring in new leaders, right? So that sort of team who've worked together before, and you know, I think you know, we definitely prioritize culture in the company and sort of like how do we collaborate and work together. You know, I think there's always this this tension of like building protocols need to scale and need to work well, but there's also so that takes planning and thought. At the same time, we're in a market that prioritizes speed to market and rapid feedback, and there's a strong tension between sort of building solid architecture versus racing and getting things out. And that's something that we're constantly working on, like how to balance those and how to, you know, get things done quickly. It's also one of the great things about being reasonably small, like we're 20 people, so we're able to run quite quickly and with this minimum coordination. Whereas as you scale an organization to 100 people and 1,000 people, it gets way, way harder to coordinate.
Yeah, 20 people is like a great size for a company, I think. You're still pretty nimble, but you have all the resources that you need.
Exactly. So it's good. I mean, we've been reasonably stable. Like we've been about 20 people for, you know, about the last year, you know, and yep. I think we're entering into the next phase of growth coming up. So pros and cons, like each phase of growth is a new set of challenges. You get more done, but just coordination costs get higher, right?
Yeah. So the AI agent, you know, in the past month or even 3 months has been dynamically evolving and also growing very rapidly. Like, how do you see Theoric differentiating itself from, you know, the rest of the market or from competitors?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's still there's so many problems to solve and so many ways that we've built really powerful technology to solve those that I think what we're seeing is coordinating swarms in a robust way, allowing them to scale, allowing them to message, allowing them to reliably transact high value transactions. These are hard problems, they're not well solved, and we're in a really strong position to solve. And then, you know, we think there's so many opportunities to integrate with other great companies, right? Data providers, you know, launch pads, you know, ecosystems, frameworks, right? That our technology just naturally integrates with those and fantastic agent providers, right? Like we think that agents are going to increasingly be discovering and cooperating, and what we're offering is superpowers for those agents, right? So at this point, we think there's just a lot more exciting partnerships ahead and a lot of ways that we can really accelerate the field. But, you know, I think the space is moving so fast that, you know, you've got to deliver every day. You've got to keep driving adoption because the market will quickly solve open problems. So if you don't do it, someone else will.
Got to move fast.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think it sounds great and the future looks very bright, Ron. And now it's like a rapid fire round. So I'm going to ask you some quick questions. You can definitely give longer answers as you wish. We are not so particular. So are you ready?
Sure.
How would you describe Theoric's mission in one word?
The word would be empowerment. We really want to empower people to control AI and to have the AI that works for them.
Yeah, sounds good. In the last 10 years, which book do you think that you've read and it's influenced your life in a particular way and why?
I mean, it's a tough one, but one that jumps to mind is The Precipice by Toby Ord, which is really about existential risk and the future of humanity. You know, it talks about how we're in this unique period in human history where we have technologies that are powerful enough to wipe us all out, but not the wisdom necessarily to manage them. And so we're going through this perilous, critical period, and hopefully we end up on the other side where we're in a wonderful future where we're not at that risk. But, you know, I think it's a very thoughtful book. And, you know, it certainly came out a few years before today's AI boom, but was certainly influential in my thinking.
I can see that happening, though I don't know how I feel about it. But yeah. What's the most underrated skill for founders?
I think the most underrated skill for founders is actually building culture. People often don't realize culture is like so essential in any company, right? And like it becomes incredibly sticky. And so when you start the company, you know, the founders just basically are the culture. And as they bring in the first people, the decisions, the way you work together, the types of people you bring in, that really sets the stage for what is the culture. Mm-hmm. So people often look at the tangible output and not sort of the culture is really that operating system for the organization that determines its long-term success, right? So that's probably the most important job of a founder. And yet, you know, you often see, you rarely see it be even being discussed in advice for entrepreneurs. So I think that's why it's so underrated and so critical.
Yeah, I think because like in the beginning, they don't even have time for that, right? Only when the company becomes a little bigger and there are like disputes and then you get the time. So what kind of culture do you want to inculcate in your company?
I mean, you know, I'd say you're right in a sense that like often people, you know, if you're a first time entrepreneur, it's overwhelming and you're just trying to get the basic things done. But, you know, once you've done it before, you sort of realize like, hey, where this is going and let's plan for success and like, let's be intentional, right? So like as founders, when we started, we said, hey, let's really brainstorm what are the things we want to have and like agree on like with some intention, right? So things like, you know, rather than customer obsession, community obsession, right? We want to, you know, really have a way of serving all the stakeholders and not just customers, right? And things like balancing where we want innovation with people to be able to be innovative on their own and yet support a culture of constructive collaboration where people can disagree, right? I think that like, you know, that there's too much, you know, certainly at the time, you know, even 3 years ago, it was more of this of a sense of like, oh, well, you know, you can't disagree with anybody, like that's culturally bad. And we're like, no, I mean, you have to have honest disagreements in a startup and surface the things that are a concern, right? And come to a decision, right? Like that's important to have that built into the culture, right? So those are some of the kinds of things that we really emphasized in our culture. And I think we've needed to carry through and they've served us well, right? Like I think, you know, as a founding CEO, like the biggest mistake you can make is to think that you have all the answers. And if you don't create that collaboration where people can share concerns, you know, you're not going to course correct fast enough, right? Like as a team, the collective intelligence of a high performing team is going to outperform any one person and you have to enable that.
Wow, that sounds great. I hope we all find such startups to work with.
Well, also like we want to work at a place where we enjoy working, right? Like this is our life. Like we want to enjoy work and contribute and not it's a miserable experience, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's a great perspective. So if you are not doing this, like this tech, AI, crypto, crazy life, what do you think you would be doing in a parallel universe? You know, something that you enjoy. You enjoy this as well, but enjoy it in a different way.
I mean, I'd probably be working on an AI safety nonprofit, right? If I weren't doing this, you know, AI safety is incredibly important. I think we can make some real contributions around governance as multiple agents work together in swarms. So I think we'll be able to make a major contribution in that area. But to me, that's the defining problem, you know, from here until AI, AGI, super intelligence. So I think it's an incredibly important problem.
Yeah. That's nice. What's your favorite AI agent capability?
I mean, I think it's the ability to help everyone achieve their goals, right? So like empowering more people to do what they want. I think that's really the superpower of agents and something that's really exciting.
Yeah, I think it has like sort of changed my life a lot and given me a lot of time for things that I would, have not done alternatively. If you could solve one global challenge using AI, what would it be and why?
I mean, I think aging is like this huge challenge that we all face. And like, we don't need to be resigned to the idea that we all need to get old and suffer and die. Like we can, with AI, we have a legitimate chance of, you know, ending that tyranny of aging. I mean, and I think people still will die, right? Even if you don't age, eventually there's accidents and whatnot. But like, it's just so sad. I mean, seeing loved ones as they age and lose function, maybe go through dementia or physical disabilities, it's horrible. And we shouldn't accept it. And with AI, we don't need to.
Yeah, maybe we are not that far, actually. Let's see. By the time maybe we are old, it's sorted. Okay, so this is actually the last one. If you have like a conversation with a 20 years younger Ron, what is the advice you want to give to him?
I mean, you know, like the easy thing is like, you have so much more context of what's going to happen or what might be happening in 20 years and like steer to where that puck is going. So that it's sort of not fair, I guess, to say that. I mean, I think a lot of the stuff I talked about in terms of culture and how to work as a leader came out of, you know, lessons of, you know, I was too much like, well, I see where this is going, and like more sort of telling people what to do, and got some really good feedback, you know, in a past startup that like, well, it might be clear to you where you want to take things, but it's not clear to the rest of the team what the strategy is and why. And so like, this is why it's like, I've talked about, you know, these ideas of like establishing culture and how do you kind of have the right team dynamic to share ideas so that you go further by working together, even if you sort of race off faster on your own. So that's probably the advice for a 20-year younger me.
So communicate. Is that the...
That's like communicate and like really, not just communicate, but listen, right? And sort of more collaborative, right? I think definitely I've become a more collaborative leader. I think those are probably that's probably the biggest advice for 20
years. No, I agree. Because I feel like a lot of times founders have like this vision and strategy in their head, but... And they expect the team to sort of like go in their head and understand what's going on. And it's not very openly discussed or even, you know, taken feedback on. So, yeah, I think that's a really good note to remember. Okay, so I think with that, we are done and we covered a lot. And you were amazing with all the answers. And thank you to Sachi and Kenzie for hosting this episode. And Ron, thank you for giving us your time. And everybody listening, and we will be back with another founder story next month. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. It was great to be here.